Welcome to Fine Music Radio's Creative Teen Talk. I'm Mark Falconer. As a headmaster, I often get asked, why should my child study music? And we've been fortunate enough to chat to Francois de Toy, and we're continuing the discussion on focusing on teens and music and creativity and orchestras and ensembles and bands. And joining us today is Cape Town Philharmonic's principal guest conductor, Bernard Geller. And I really was so privileged to attend a few weeks ago the Beethoven and Brahms concert, which Bernhard conducted and Francois de Toy played. And I can truly say that it was the best concert I have ever been to. It really was exceptional. And Bernhard, I don't know if you felt the same.
Yeah. Thank you for these very nice opening words, and there was something special in the air in this concert. And the interesting thing is that you only have a limited influence on whether these things happen, these special things. What makes a concert special? Because what we can do in rehearsals is to create the conditions as good as we can that this can happen. There's no guarantee that it happens. But it can. You have to think about creating as good as you can these conditions, and sometimes it happens. And I think this concert was something like this.
It's a wonderful job you do. I think that there's something really symbolic about the role that you play in bringing together people with such diverse talents, skills. And what you do is you elicit something that is transporting, something that is magical. How did you get into this wonderful job that you do?
That is very difficult to talk about, because to a certain degree I don't know. Especially this job of a conductor. There is a big part of it which you don't know how it happens, why it happens, and that sometimes is frustrating, but sometimes it's also a wonderful thing, because you think there is really something beyond our intellect or beyond our materialistic thinking. But as I said, we have to rehearse that we get the music as perfect as possible, meaning playing together, playing the right notes, get all the transitions from one tempo to the other, that all these things work, that you have to rehearse. That doesn't happen by itself. But then you wait, what's happening now? And that is sometimes very, very tense. You come to a concert, you go to the stage, you go to your podium, and then you think, what will happen today? And then if there happens something, oh, that's very nice, then it encourages you. And then it's easier that another thing happens. And then two, then three. And then sometimes it can go very far. The opposite is also possible.
I want you to try and tease some of that out, because there's some conductors who happen to just luckily have these magical moments many more than others, and you are one of them. It's like a little bit like Gary Player. I think it was Gary Player. I can't remember who it was, who said, the more I practice, the luckier I get.
I think
that's... You're very lucky.
But that is what I said at the beginning. You have to create these conditions that it can happen. If you don't do anything, then it won't happen.
So what I'd like to explore a little is the creativity. Now, clearly you are able to elicit the kind of creative energy in an orchestra. I mean, I watched you do it, which was a wonderful experience for all of the people in the concert hall. Is there something that you are aware of that you do to elicit that kind of creativity? Or is it something that you think just happens and you don't know about it? Is there something specific?
You have to... It starts with that you have to have a very firm imagination of a piece which you perform. you cannot wait what happens in a rehearsal. Mm. Oh, maybe we can do it like this. You have to have a very clear imagination of this piece. And then you have to try to get as close as possible to this imagination. But that means, before that, you have to read the score. And you have to make this thing sounding in your head. And you have to be absolutely on your own. It has to be very quiet. And then you have many performances in your head. One of the most ideal places is when you are in a plane on a long flight. Mm. And you sit there, especially at night when everything is... And then I very often go through a whole symphony from the first to the last note.
In your head?
In my head. And then there come ideas. And each time it changes a bit, or a new idea is added to maybe we can do this. What is this piece about? Is it a dramatic piece? Is it a sad piece? Is it more positive? And in all these things you have to get into, very deeply into. And then you also have to find some analogies that you can work with pictures, that you don't have to say, here, play a little bit softer and then a bit stronger and then a bit farther, but say something like a scene of, mm. of. I remember one when we played, oh God, that is now 40 years ago, when we did we made a recording with Carlos Kleiber. And he wanted at some place as a pianissimo, but with substance. Mm. And he said, that has to sound like an engine of a Rolls Royce, which you almost can't hear, but you hear that it has 12 cylinders. Mm. Mm. Such pictures bring out much more than 1,000 explanations.
So if I have to summarize what you're saying and I make it applicable to parents, to teachers, the analogy that you use as a conductor, I mean, I think there is a connection between being a conductor and being a teacher or being a parent, because you're talking about boundaries, that you need to be clear and firm and strong. You're talking about containment, that you need to make sure that your group knows who's in charge and what direction they're going in. You're talking about preparation, what you need to do to make sure that you arrive and can lead this group of people, however creative and talented they are. You're talking about clarity, being able to communicate clearly, and you're talking about vision, that you can lead them to where it is that you want them to go, but you have to have that vision for that to happen.
Then there's another important thing. When you have done all of this, the thinking and... Then you have to have the ability with your movement to transfer that to the orchestra, that they can do it. Mm. Because a movement very often says more than every explanation, verbal mm. explanation. I myself have experienced conductors, when I was still playing in the orchestra, they said wonderful things. And then they started conducting and they destroyed it with their conduct. But they didn't realize it because,
Clearly you've had many, many wonderful successes all over the world. Can you think of any examples that you have of where it's really gone wrong? You know, where you've had an experience where you think you have not elicited the kind of creativity, and has that ever happened?
Yeah, I think more at the beginning of my career in Germany. There was one or two orchestras where
You were in Stuttgart?
I was playing in Stuttgart, but conducting in other offices also, where you feel there is no connection somehow. You can do whatever you like, you can say whatever you like. It doesn't work. And that's also something which you don't actually know why. Mm. That also happens. But thank God, not very often.
I know that you've had quite a lot of experience with youth orchestras. Is there anything different that you do with a youth orchestra than you would do with a more experienced and professional orchestra?
No. And nothing. I think that's a very important point, that you take these young people, series. I always talk to youth orchestras as if I would have a professional orchestra there. Because this patronizing way of, you still can't do this, you are only play since 2 years or what, I cannot expect this. That is counterproductive. You have to take them seriously, and you have to ask for things which you actually know maybe they can't do that, but you ask for it. Because if you ask this, you get this. Mm. If you ask this, you get this. Mm. So you have, that's, I think, very, very important to take seriously. Don't let them know that they're only a youth orchestra or an amateur orchestra.
And so another thing for our leadership seminar, don't be condescending, because you know, if you expect the best, then that's wonderful. That's really wonderful. And I think that's something that teachers all over the world could learn from. Mm. Are you able to identify particular people you would want to concentrate on in an orchestra? Can you see that maybe there's a particular problem or a particular talent that you want to elicit or keep control when you start conducting? Or is that not something that you pay attention to? Do you expect everyone to work as a unit?
It depends on what you want to do. If, first of all, when you have this orchestra, especially when you meet this orchestra, you must also, or you have to avoid to show that you prefer somebody or you don't care about them or you let them know that they are not so good. Treat them equally. But there are sometimes people who really stick out, especially when it's soloistic. In the woodwinds, in the brass, that's easier to find. In a group of 12, 14 violins, it's difficult to find out who is particularly good. Also, you can more see this than hearing. Mm. How somebody plays, how he holds the instrument, you see, they probably don't play it very long, and they are very experienced, and so on. But you can't really hear it so well. But with woodwinds it's easier because they very often have a solo and then you hear exactly what's going on. And then one can then talk to them after the rehearsal that you maybe should do that, you should go to another teacher or you should go to a chamber group or whatever advice you can give. But you don't do it in front of the whole orchestra.
Well, some more good advice for teachers, I think, yeah. And parents maybe. We've just come through a really, really tough position for everyone in the world with this COVID pandemic. Do you think musicians have anything that we could learn from in terms of resilience, in terms of grit, in terms of adaptability in dealing with what has been a real challenge, particularly for performers?
Well, yeah, I think I particularly can talk about this orchestra. They played during the pandemic under extremely difficult circumstances. Mm,
mm. Little glass cages at one point, wasn't it?
Especially when we did these streaming concerts, where, first of all, they were sitting far apart from each other. Mm. Then every single woodwind player had a plastic cage around him. Every single one, not the group, every single one. The brass was far away, and that made it, I mean, we were really fighting, because they couldn't hear each other anymore very well. For me, it was much too soft, because at some stage I also had a plastic thing around me, so that the sound had to come over their plastic box, then over my plastic box. Of course, it was much too late, and too soft. And to bring this together was very hard. But at the end, I was amazed how, nevertheless, we did quite good concerts. It was insane. And the orchestra showed really determination and patience, and they did a wonderful job. And I think that was something which also demonstrated themselves what we can actually do if we have to. Mm. To work together under difficult circumstances. Yeah. As much as I hate this, but sometimes it also has a good effect.
Positive
effect.
Do you think there's a correlation or any kind of connections that you could pick out between any of the other creative arts, so poetry, drama, dance, art? Do you think there's something that you would say that's the kind of creative life, and each one of those has something to offer those kinds of creative kids?
You would say, no wonder he says that, but I think from all these
I know where you're going.
arts, music is number one. It comes from so deep inside a human being and goes so deeply into another, if it's an understanding person, which no other art form does. It can move you like no other art form can do. And what is very important for young people to that one makes them go into this kind of art form is that they, from as early as possible, not only listen to music from a speaker, but that they see how their parents or friends or whatever do it. That is the most important and most convincing way to lead young kids to classical music, that they see how it's done.
The connection I would make is with any kind of team sport. You know, if you're aware of how each person plays their part, how each position has got its own particular role, and how each needs to come together to make something that is more than the sum of its parts. If you can be aware of how an orchestra works, what the work is that goes to weld and form that, out of which comes such unbelievable transporting magic, then you are going to be in a better position to just ask people to listen to a song on the radio. Mm-hmm. Not a song, a concerto or a symphony is going to be a very difficult
and
to
also
start with.
Many say, also scientists say, that children who are playing classical music, whether it's chamber music or orchestra music, have an advantage, greater social intelligence. It's a stimulus to the brain that they really profit more than enjoying classical music. But it does something to your head, and that is, I think, a very encouraging thing. And I say that should be more famous, because parents, who doesn't want more intelligent people, children, and if you could convince them that is, for example, a way to improve this, do it.
I mean, you've been playing in countries that have generally been quite privileged. You know, you Canada and many, many countries in Europe. In South Africa, we've got other challenges. I mean, we have a very divided society. How do you allow people who don't have that privilege, how do you allow them to see what music can offer?
Well, you have to bring them together with the music, whether the orchestra goes to plays or you bring the children in to the city here. I would say that's a more effective way.
The Cape Town Philharmonic has done a lot of work in that regard.
And try to explain at least the basics and see how they react. If they are very young, it's probably more difficult than if they listen to let's say a chamber group where they can also talk to the people, and there's more connection, more direct connection than to a big orchestra. But it starts with bring these two together, and important, give them an instrument to do this. I heard just some weeks ago, I talked to my brother in Germany. In Berlin, they did. There was a Turkish-born man. I don't actually know what he's doing. He started a project to go to disadvantaged people, foreigners, Turkish from Islamic countries or whatever. So socially very, very down, and bring them together, give them an instrument, and get a teacher and learn this instrument. And if they are on a certain level, bring them together to play something. The success was overwhelming. These people, they enjoyed, they couldn't believe that, first of all, that there is something like classical music. The parents of these were most proud. They were crying when they asked them, what do you think about it? You see, it was unbelievable how successful that was. And that is very encouraging. And
it's a beautiful story.
If it happens there, why not here?
Yes, why not here? Bernhard, the last question, and maybe this will take us the circle. You have played in an orchestra, and then you clearly made a decision to become a conductor. What inspired that? I love the analogy of a conductor and the symbolic value it has of, you know, eliciting something more, you know, the Aristotle quote, more than the sum of its parts, which is so apt for what you do. What inspired you?
Well, this wish to conduct was very old. When I was a little boy, I was listening to some Beethoven symphony and it's already. But then somehow one didn't really know how to get there. What do you have to do? Then if you want to study conducting on a college, then you have to play piano. That was one of the basic requests. I couldn't play piano. I played cello. So that was also, and then also the idea was actually from this piece which we are playing just now, I have actually a completely different imagination. I would like to do it faster, whatever. And that is very frustrating. The more you have a firm imagination, but you always have to do something else, what another guy says, can be a big conflict. And I thought, I have to find a way out.
So you wanted creative freedom. You wanted
Yes. And then came this competition from the German radio stations. And then I thought, that is my last chance to do something. And I took part in this, and I won it. And from that on, it took then
that was
still
a competition, a
conducting competition. Yes. Took still a long time. I was playing in the orchestra and conducted other orchestra. Thank God I had a very tolerant employer and they let me go. And then I came here as a guest conductor in 94. And after a short time, they offered me a position here with the in those times, Cape Town Symphony Orchestra. Later they merged it to the... And then I came here and then...
Beautiful.
The rest.
So creative freedom. That was
It was actually because that is the big advantage of being a conductor, which is also, and one also has to say, it's actually an anachronism, especially in our time, because this dictatorship from conductor to orchestra doesn't happen in any other, not even in the military, because a general cannot ask or order the army what they have to feel, or nothing, or being said.
I mean, that's a fascinating point, because some people would say that you are so circumscribed in what you can do with it. I mean, if you have a symphony, you know, you've got clear instructions about how, you know, how Beethoven is recommending it's played. You know, you've got notes. You've got orchestration. How much freedom do you really have?
Maybe less than somebody who improvises in jazz. But I think, for example, Gardiner gives up much too much freedom, because you say there is everything, almost everything written, but between all of these notes, lines, marks, there is so much freedom what you can do. Because listen to five performances of Brahms 4. Each one is different. Even those who say, I do only what's written in the score, even that is an interpretation. And even that, whether this conductor wants or not, something goes in from him.
Yeah.
But that's nothing what one should do. The highest aim of a conductor is to be faithful to the score. Mm. It's not possible. It is not possible.
I mean, it is quite incredible what happens, because I mean, after that concert, I listened to the Brahms Piano Concerto four different interpretations, four different conductors and soloists. And each one was wonderful in its own way, but nothing was as wonderful as the Cape Town Philharmonic Orchestra's Thursday concert. And although the notes were the same, there was something quite magical and incredible, enchanting.
That's what also makes music the first art. Mm. Because each time you play, this piece is recreated. Mm. If you have a painting, that's done. It will never change. It's always the same. Or a sculpture, or a building, or whatever. Music each time. Not really composed again, but in a way recreated. And if you play with the same orchestra, the same piece, 5 days a week, it will be every time a little bit different.
I'm so sad. We're going to have to come to an end. There's a whole leadership symposium here that you've spoken about. All of these wonderful things about boundaries and preparation and vision and communication and being able to elicit without any condescension. All of that has been really wonderful and inspiring speaking to you. And I'm so grateful for your insights and for everything that you've added to our talk on creativity. So I am grateful. Thank you very much, Bernard.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Fine Music Radio's Creative Teen Talk podcast series was hosted by headmaster, educator, and parent Mark Faulkner. It was produced by FMR's Vanessa Levenstein and Ewan Inglis. FMR.